I would like to invite each of you to listen carefully to God's voice in your heart. Listen to His voice. Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid.
Hello and welcome. I'm Father Chad Arnold, and you are listening to About 4 O'Clock, a podcast on vocations and discernment. We are just laboring away today in the blessed Stanley Rother studio, and in the Finca with me today, Father Garrett Burns.
What the heck?
And Father Drew Hoffman.
I don't know what that means. I don't like it at all.
You don't commonly use the phrase Finca?
No, that sounds like some young person slang.
Yeah, well, I wish it were. It actually has to do with our patron saint, blessed of the studio today. I almost wanted to say like in the vineyard with me today, but you know, makes sense for family, Father Stanley Rother as a priest, but there weren't vineyards in Guatemala. So what he was working among were the workers in the coffee plantations, which they call them fincas down there. Oh. So you work at a finca. So it's kind of a stretch like being in the vineyard, but you're in the finca with me
today. I don't think it's going to catch on, but it's worth trying.
In a month's time, everyone is going to be using this phrase. I was down in Guatemala for a while, a few years back, with some seminary and studying English. And one of the schools we went to, they call it the Mountain School. And it runs a coffee plantation, an old coffee plantation for it. And so they're showing us how to do it. One of the things you have to do at a coffee plantation, there's these mountainous walls that the coffee plants are growing out, and you have to take little scrapers and go out along the bark and scrape the lichen and the moss that grows on it, because otherwise it sucks the nutrients from the tree and the coffee's worse. And so they're telling us, this is how that's done. We want you guys to experience. They give us all these little scrapers, and there's like 20 of us out standing on this mountainside scraping them. Like, no, you're missing a pit, so you got to do it better. And I'm doing this all of 5 minutes. I'm like, wait a minute. They are just using us to get this work done.
Free labor.
It was Tom Sawyer
exactly,
with a fence.
Exactly. It was brilliant on their part.
That's what happens in a finca.
That's
We've
what
all
happens
been there
in
among
a,
us.
Right. That's how you use the phrase correctly. Okay. So if you are tricking someone into doing work, like I have tricked you into being this podcast for my own you're bringing them onto the finca. So that's what it means on the street. If you're in North Wichita and drop the term finca.
Good to be in the finca with y'all.
Everyone will know. Well, I do have to confess, sometimes I use this podcast to make you guys talk about things I'm just curious about.
Okay.
That may not be of any help to any discerners or even interesting people out there, but there are thoughts that I think about, like, I know what's going on in my life, but I think I've never actually asked another priest this, if they have similar experiences with this or what goes on in their head. So today's opening topic has to do with that. And so what I want to know is what, if anything, goes through your head right after you give a homily. So that moment of you've just finished the homily and you're walking back to the chair. So thinking probably like a Sunday homily more than a weekday homily. But do any prayers or thoughts go through your head between the ambo and the chair? Because for me, I have like a micro conversation there with God. And I know what mine looks like, but I don't know if other people do this and if it's similar experience to mine. So this question is purely for my own curiosity.
Usually it's like, dang it. Like, I did not say that right like I wanted to say that.
All right, this is already helping me. This is good. This is good.
I'd say that's usually the first sentiment, the first words out of my heart.
Yeah, I would say, so I have 4:30 on Saturday, 10 a.m., 7 p.m., and 9 p.m. on Sunday. And just the way my homily prep is that I have, I don't have notes up there. I have a outline that I've made beforehand. It's always a 5-point outline, and I fill in the blanks with it. But just my processing, I have to say it and to kind of get there. Like, I need to say it out loud. And usually I'll do that, obviously, before the homily. But what that means is that my 4:30 homily is almost always a mess.
Yeah.
It's almost always like working out what works and what doesn't. And I was joking with somebody at the clergy conference. I was joking about this because they brought this up, as an older priest brought this up to me, about those poor Saturday night people.
Oh, gosh. They get the worst homilies all the time.
They always do.
Make note, people. Yeah. Sometimes it's better go on Sunday.
Yes.
You're going to get a better homily.
It is true.
So there's usually, as I walk back, it's usually, dang it. Like, that did not make any sense. Father Kiner used to say homolicide.
Yeah. Homolicide.
That's what he would use.
I've never heard that. I love that.
And then usually at the 10, I'm like, we missed the mark a little bit, but we did fine. And then 7 and 9, I've got it pretty much down. And so there's not much conversation when I go back. But usually, and this is like not a self-flagellation stuff like that. Honestly, when I give bad homilies, it almost always then leads into deeper Eucharistic prayer. That's been my experience because not in like I need to make up for it, but
right. But you're a second half team. You are the Chiefs.
They had us there in the first half, but it's a better realization to me of how grateful I am that the homily is such a small part of the Mass and such a tiny portion. I remember this would happen when we said Mass for the football team for Father Gale and I for, with K-State. We would always leave like, I'm so happy that's what I'm able to give them. They think the homily was what I was able to give them, and I make a big pressure on myself for that, but I was able to give them Jesus, and that's much more important. So my worst homilies end up being actually my more intense experiences of prayer at Mass.
Yeah. That point is such a point of regular consolation for me with the homily. You know, obviously, we spend more time typically working on our homily than any other part of the Mass. Yeah. I don't practice the Eucharistic prayer anymore. But I work a lot on the homily, and then I give it, I'm like, thank God they're not here for the homily.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter how good the homily is. If it's a great homily, it still pales in comparison to the Eucharist. And so there's a lot of consolation in that, especially with the daily Mass goers, because sometimes the daily Mass homily, it's a strikeout. But I'm like, these people are here for Jesus. If they're here for daily Mass, they're here for Jesus. And that's comforting.
Yeah.
Are you ever just like, I killed it, bro. Like you're one to give high fives as you head back.
Every once in a while. Yeah. So for me, there's those, I would say they're rare, but every once in a while, there's the moment I'm walking back from the end. I'm like, thank you, Lord, that the words came out. And those seem to be like the homilies no one comments on afterwards.
Never.
The plane wrecks are the one they come up. Wow, that was a great homily. That's what I needed. What homily were you listening to? But when I walk from the amber to the chair, I'm saying, Lord, thank you for those words. Those were the words I needed to give. Dead silence after Mass. No one like, nothing.
Or they'll compliment your public speaking. And I was like, that's not really the point of this. It's like, it wasn't because it was a well-structured, those are the most like, it was a well-structured homily. It's like, I don't know that that's a virtue necessarily. Yeah. Just
got English teachers going to your Mass.
Yes, I mean.
No, I remember somebody saying that after one, like, oh, I can tell they taught you well, like how a 3-paragraph essay or something like Bishop Carroll back in the day. I'm like, okay, do you know what I said? Did it impact your life at all? Yeah.
I think initially my most common thing that I would say between the ambo and the chair when I first started preaching was, I'm sorry. That was my prayer to the
Mea
Lord.
Culpa.
I mean, similar to this day,
I'm sorry.
It's not because I didn't prepare. It would just not come off where I'm at. And it wasn't like, again, it wasn't a self-pleasure. It's just like, it's kind of a sense of, Lord, sorry. And there are those moments where it's like, Lord, thanks for the words for that. Kider was actually, so him and I were associates together, and he gave me one of the phrases that I repeat most often going back and forth there. After I say, I'm sorry, well, they can't all be good. So that is like one of my regular moments of comfort. They can't all be good.
But I think, it leads to that deeper prayer, hopefully. Like, absolutely. That's something I've grown in. I know a lot of times in my first couple of years, I'm almost like distracted as I'm praying the Eucharistic prayer. Cause I'm like, oh, maybe what would it be a better way to say this? Mm-hmm. And you're a little bit on autopilot. And then I remember a priest telling me, I've learned to pray more after the homily than before the homily. Yeah. Even more than I do preparing, I should pray afterwards that those, whatever I said, plants a seed and that flourishes and blooms. So I think that kind of taking that sentiment, and you can have a moment of dang it, or I'm sorry, or just like, all right, I tried. But then that hopefully that leads into, as you're saying, pray the Eucharistic prayer more deeply and like use that, Lord. I don't know what it was, but use it.
Yeah. I think that's kind of where these days a lot of that micro conversation I have with the Lord has gone to in the prayer of, and it's more of a comforting, Lord, use that as you will. I'm kind of interested to see how you'll use that. It almost is kind of the conversation because I know the points I'm hitting or I want to lead people in the homily, but as any priest that has ever given homily, the things people take away from the homily can be on a completely different map than where I was intending to take them with the homily. And that's fine. Again, it's a reminder that, okay, this isn't dependent upon me. The Lord's going to do what he's going to do with this. And so that's kind of the conversation. Lord, I hit that ball as well as I can. You take it from here and we'll see what you do with it. And it's not a woe is me. It's kind of an exciting, what are you going to do, Lord? And so that's kind of where my prayer is, I think, these days, a lot of times after a homily. I also find then I like the pause after the homily. So different priest style, some people go right on the petitions or the creed or whatnot. I am an advocate, and this is a hard thing to do, and I understand of parents with small children, it's harder. I am an advocate for more silence in Mass. Like, my preference is no song after communion. My preference is a moment of silence between the homily and moving on. I like silence. Again, I know that doesn't always jive with when you're wrangling a child.
Dad doesn't like little kids at Mass.
If you take one thing away from this podcast, that would be what you should take away. Looking at my nephews and nieces. No, but so in that, I try and imbue a bit of silence after the homily so I can, my own prayer, honestly, is what's going on. And so often I feel like my best homilies are where I'm preaching to myself anyways. Mm-hmm. And so then I'm like, okay, I just told people they need to pray about this. Now I need to pray about it. I've been doing it all week, but now I'm in the sanctuary. I'm in the grace of the Mass. This is a different way, different space to pray in it. And so a lot of times I'm praying, I'm like, it is almost like I just heard that homily for the first time preached to me, and I'm going back and I'm going to pray with this a little bit in that 20 seconds of silence that we allow for. But I am reassured that I'm not the only one that's ever walked away from the point. I'm like, well, dang it.
Those poor Saturday night people. That's funny that we all have the same experience.
It's true. Yeah. Saturday night. It is funny inside baseball for other people out there, but the vibes of Mass. So yeah, Saturday night people, they're not getting the best homily. First early Mass of the parish. Don't tell jokes. They don't want jokes. You know, if you're looking for feedback in that, you're not going to get any from
that's
the 8 o'clock
so
crowd.
Funny, because that's the exact same as the 9 p.m. crowd.
Oh, yeah.
So the end
about
of the day, 7's okay. The 9 p.m. crowd, limited jokes. It's the same thing.
No play.
As the, like, we're not, I'm not making the same announcements. Like, they're here for Mass. Both the 6:30 a.m. and the 9 p.m., they're here for Mass.
There's a duty to be done, and we're gonna take care of it. And then, by the at Coffeeville, it was like 8 and 10. So by the 10 o'clock Mass, warmed up. Everyone's in a good place. If I'm not too tired by that point, sometimes that can happen. If you're hitting, especially if you some scenario you've got four Mass and that fourth Mass, you gotta pony up for that. I mean, just that. But the last Mass, that's where the good homily happens. So if you want your best preaching, you got to go to Mass number 3 of whatever the
that
priest
is true.
Reading.
Sure. That's true.
For sure.
That's where you're going to get the best homily, Mass number 3. Just so you know that there. Sorry, Saturday night folk. Since we are in the studio of Blessed Stanley Rother today, it is only fitting, I think, that we spend this episode talking about him. He is one who is near us both in time and geographically. If you're unfamiliar with Father Stanley Rother, he was born in 1935 in Okarchee, Oklahoma. He is an alumni of My Theologate, Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg, Maryland. He was ordained in 1963 for Oklahoma City Diocese, and then he was martyred in Guatemala in 1981. There's a great book out about him called The Shepherd Who Didn't Run. I found the book very powerful. I find his whole life story, the witness of his priesthood, powerful and relatable. Again, geographically, he's close. The farm life of Oklahoma compared to the Wichita area, time frame, he's close. And so I've really grown in affection for him in the last several years. I've been fortunate enough, I got to say Mass where he said his first Mass, and I've got to say Mass where he said his last Mass. So I took the seminarians couple summers ago down to Oklahoma to visit the sites of Father Stanley Rother. And so I went to Okarchee and I got to say Mass with the seminarians there at the altar. And then a few years back when I was in Guatemala with the seminarians for there, we went to the parish that he died, had Mass in the room that he was martyred in, as well as Mass in the church that he was pastor of. So he's grown really important for me. I want to promote him, obviously, as you have had concerns before, Father Drew. This is not putting him before Father Capon. Father Capon's our homeboy. But I think
the martyr thing changes it a little bit. Yeah. But I do want to, I mean, no free ads. And this is a Diocese of Wichita
production.
And so, but I'm fine, of course.
The martyr thing really kind of...
It changes it.
I derailed. Because Father Stanley Rother is the first blessed U.S. priest, which Father Capon was heading for that distinction, I feel like. But the martyrdom of Father, it put him ahead in line.
Some guys
kinda.
Get all the luck.
At this stage in his life, he probably would agree with you. At this stage of his heavenly being, he'd be all for that. But anyways, us Midwest guys got to stick together, especially for those of us who have gone to the school on the East Coast, like Father Stanley and I did. you know, the East Coast Catholics, but us Midwest guys. So anyway, I'm a big fan of him. I don't know if you guys have read Shepherd Who Did Not Run, or if you have much experience of him, or have gotten into his life story very much, but I just think there's a lot of cool things to mine there.
So I read it on a plane ride to Guatemala.
Oh, wow.
Was a bad idea.
I don't read on planes, period. Yeah, so
I was going down there. I spent about a month there in between college seminary and theology. I just knew a priest down there that was at an orphanage. And so Father Jerry Beat, the late great, he gave me that. I was just like, you should learn about Father Stanley and go see his grave because you're not far from Atitlan where his heart is buried. So I'm like, okay, cool. But then I'm reading this and there's like intense persecution and he's
super intense.
Martyred, murdered. And like that's in 1981. That's not like super long ago. Right. So I'm kind of like, okay, I'm just headed down to this place. Hopefully I'll be all right. But yeah, I've just really grown to be inspired by him. Like I said, I got to go see where his heart is buried. So the people there when he was killed, you know, it's kind of his family wanted his body back and he'd be buried up in Oklahoma. But they kept his heart and just said, he gave us his heart. So it will be buried here. So just a beautiful testament of being a shepherd. I think above all, that's what we can tell that story of why the book is entitled that. But he, above all, I think just is a shepherd. He was a pastor of those people above anything else.
Yeah, as a diocese of Wichita boy, I've been faithful to chaplain. No, but I'll be honest. And I told you guys right before we went on, I don't have a lot of experience with him. I haven't been to Guatemala. I know the basics of the story and appreciate it. But I'm kind of excited to hear you guys talk about it and learn something today, too.
I have to make it down. Shout out to our Oklahoma brethren down there because they're going to have the shrine to him opening in the next year.
Have you seen it?
I've seen images of it.
It's right on 35 as you're driving. It's stunning.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Wow. As it should be.
How many people is going to hold?
I think it's 2,000.
2,000. Yeah. I think it's a 2,000 seater.
Yeah. But one of the cool things I like about Stanley Rother, and is maybe a good reminder for some people considering seminary or of the seminarians, he's another one of those examples that academics, he was not strong in. He really struggled with academics to the point that, it's funny to me, the first college seminary he was at, he could not get Latin down, could not get it. And so they actually told the diocese, we don't think this man is smart enough, and they dismissed him from the seminary, came back to his diocese, and the bishop said, well, do you believe you're supposed to be a priest? And he says, yes, I am. And said, well, we'll find another place for you, which is an awesome witness of the bishop. But the funny part about that story is the seminary that dismissed him and gave the report that he may not be smart enough to be a priest lists him today as one of their alumni.
Oh, interesting.
In their fundraising appeals, they talk about their alumni, Blessed Stanley Rother, completely brushing over the fact that they dismissed him and he never graduated from there.
Wow.
So gauntlet thrown down there. But so he went on. And again, the amazing power of our Lord to work with a willing heart. So there's this hurdle in front of him, but he still feels he's called to be a priest and struggles and gets past that. And one of the things he's known for is he couldn't learn Latin, but he goes down to Guatemala. Not only does he learn Spanish, he learns the native dialect, which I can't even pronounce the name of that language. Have you ever heard it spoken?
No.
It sounds, so it's not related to Spanish anyway. It's a derivative of Mayan. I went to a mass while I was in Guatemala, just kind of stood in the back that was in this language. It sounds almost like Portuguese to me not maybe Portuguese, maybe like even German. It's more guttural. But so not only could he not learn Latin, he learns Spanish, he learns his native language, and he learns it well enough that he begins to translate it because at that time, the language was barely written. It was just a spoken language in the mountains. And so he is one of the first creators of the New Testament in this dialect that had never been written in before. This from a guy who was dismissed from a seminary because he couldn't learn Latin. So again, where the heart is, the Lord can just come in and do tremendous things. And you see that in the witness of Father Stanley Rother and his relationship to academics.
Yeah, just incredible what he was able to do, like with that heart image, just because he was like, I'm just going to give my entire heart to these people. It's been always a big inspiration to me and just doing Hispanic ministry and struggling with that in language and sometimes, but you can always give your heart and the people are going to respond to that. And just amazing to see what you can do with it. Like if he's cool to see with me, like if you see videos or you just imagine like his beatification mass, like so you have this farmer from Oklahoma. So it's just kind of these simple farm, rural people.
Mm-hmm.
But then he served in Guatemala. So there's a lot of immigrants and Hispanic community that have a great devotion to him in the diocese. So it's all these people that come together. And if a priest just, if a man just says a yes to God, these are the kind of things like nobody else is bringing those two people, yeah, those two groups of people together, right, to be honest, right now. But a man that says yes to God can do it. So yeah.
One of the neat things too, with him being so recent, is he's still very much alive in memory for many people. So his sister is still alive and lives at a convent here in Wichita. Mm-hmm. So see, Drew, he's got relations here.
I used to work with her at the Lord's Diner.
Yeah.
When I worked for 2 summers at the Lord's Diner. And the thing I remember, and I don't remember if she said this to me or if the other people around said that she said this to him, is when people, how normal he was.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't this heavy hagiographies of, we found him in the chapel every morning. We always knew that sainthood was ahead of him and things like that. The normalcy that she emanates, and just even knowing the sister of a saint makes it normal. But the way she even talked about him, mm-hmm, normalizes it. And that normalizing then has to move us into response. Not just being like, anybody can be a saint. Well, that's true. But he did some crazy cool stuff to make that a reality.
Yeah. When I was in Coffeyville, my sacristan was his cousin. And so she would talk a little bit about him too and pray. And one of the cool things to see in that is when she talked about him, it wasn't like we talk about the saints and they're a little bit ethereal. They're a little bit off there, but she was just talking about a deceased family member. And mm-hmm, that's a whole different way. And it really brought home to me, these are real people, that this is a real possibility. This is what sanctity looks like. It's not just something out of the golden legend or things like that. This was a man who had faults, who had strengths, who sometimes knew the right thing to do, sometimes didn't, and just had to make a good judgment call and was guided by the Spirit and allowing the Lord to lead him. And amazing things happened because of that.
I think he did a lot of very charitable and amazing things, but they were very natural in that too. And it was normal, like, especially where he was serving, they didn't have schools and hospitals and like no one to stand up for them to the government that was against them and things like that. So I remember one story, it was like he was put on the death list and things like that. And the reasoning was he is defending the people. Like that was just what he did. He would stand up and say to, you know, one of the local governors or whatever, you say you're trying to help the people, but why are my people dying? And why do they not have any food? Why, you know, all of these things. That's just what he did. He just defended the people and he knew the people and he gave food to the aging and he saved an infant and he did. So it wasn't like they're amazing things, but they're also just kind of normal human things, but no one else was doing them for these people.
Right. Right. And there's human elements of his story that come out that, you know, I think about, I always remember when you read about his actual martyrdom. So if you know the story, he knew he was on a death list. He's back working in his parish. The fact that he went back at all is another thing we should talk about. But so he's in the rectory. He's sleeping in hidden spots because at this time in Guatemala, people are entering into homes that work for the government or the other things, removing them and torturing them and killing them. And this had been happening to his parishioners and people that stood up for it. So he is hiding in different places in the rectory, sleeping different nights. 3 gunmen break in. They find a sacristan who is taking sanctuary, basically, in the rectory. They find him. At gunpoint, they force him to lead them to Father Stanley Rother, and he just knocks on their father, they're here. And when they were examining the body, his knuckles and his hands were all bloodied because he fought them. And there was actually part of the debate of whether they would recognize him as a martyr or not, because, you know, traditionally we talk about the martyrs, you know, going joyfully to their death. And so these 3 gunmen come in. Their plan was to take him out, torture him, and kill him. And he fought them, and so they end up putting a bullet in his head there in that room, which is now a shrine. But part of the reason they decided that they would recognize him as a martyr and that this didn't count against that idea is what he had been telling people beforehand is because so many people trusted him with where their family members and things were hiding. He was afraid that in his own weakness, if they took him and tortured him, he might say something that would endanger part of his flock. And so he knew he was going to die. And so in order to protect his flock, his idea is I've got to make sure this kind of happens here. And so he wasn't going to let them take him out quietly. And so he was fighting these 3 guys until they killed him in that room. But even that act of fighting wasn't an act to preserve his life. It was an act to preserve the lives of others. And so those just very human details come out in his story and in a way that it's harder to access with older saints.
So did the sacristan live?
I believe so.
Is that how they know? I mean, otherwise, because no one was ever caught or anything.
No, correctly. So I think as soon as they were, you know, as soon as they fired the gun, they fled, and he went and got the sisters who were living next door, and they came in. And so in addition to his heart down there, they have, you know, vials of his blood, because the sisters already recognizing what a holy man he was, saved the blood from that point that was on the floor there. And so when you say mass in that room, they still have like the tile, the bullet that passed through his skull into the ground, and it's stained with blood around them. They've got a little glass over it there, and it's right next to the altar. So you're saying that with that off to the side. It's powerful.
And you could make that argument well that he was ready to accept martyrdom because he was even there, right? Like you were talking about. Like, so he was on the death list and he does decide to come back to Oklahoma. Yeah,
share the story about him having to leave and then come back and why the book's named what it is.
Yeah, so just the basic story that I know of. Yeah, so Bishop and his family, I think everybody's like, it's getting really tense. You're on the death list.
He knew it.
Yeah, he knows he's on the death list. And I think it was something like part of the reason he was on the death list was because he was burying the dead, which is, again, just a natural Christian thing. So he's coming back, trying to discern, is he going to get another assignment? What's he going to do? And then inspired by that line from the gospel, he says, the shepherd cannot flee, or the shepherd cannot abandon his flock to fend for themselves. So just a shepherd so given over to his people, to his flock, that when the wolves are there and they're there with guns in Guatemala, the shepherd doesn't run. So I'm going to go back. So the one that shows, he's ready to accept martyrdom because I'm going to go back into it. And to me, has been a beautiful expression of even that tension between a priest and his family. Like I can't imagine his family living and like, why are you going back there?
Yeah.
You know, like you're probably going to die.
I think either his mom or his dad have a statement like, we knew when he left, we would not see him alive again. They knew that when he went back.
And pray God, none of us have to ever make that level, that depth of that decision. But on little ways, we have to do that a lot of, I'm not going to be there for this or that, or I have to make some sort of sacrifice because I'm given over to my flock and I can't not be there. Mm-hmm. So.
And if I remember the timeline correctly, and I could be remembering this, I should have looked it up before we talked about this, but he was either going back in time for Easter. I think it was Easter. And which again, it's a beautiful priestly thing. The idea that the highest feast day of the year, I can't leave my flock because if I'm not there, there's not going to be mass on Easter. And so he goes back in time for Easter so that he can celebrate Easter with his people.
One of the other things I learned recently was, I think just it shows what one holy man can do, I guess, is that the parish there in Atitlan was established in 1547. And there were zero priests from that parish for 400 years. Since Father Rother died, there's been, I think, 7 priests and there's 9 in the seminary right now from that one parish. So just to see the ripple effect of a life lived is pretty amazing.
Yeah, 40 years compared to 400 years. Yeah, it's true. Another detail I love about Father Stanley, very important, is that he drove from Oklahoma down to Guatemala the first time with it, and he drove a Ford Bronco.
Oh, wow.
One of the many ways in which Stanley and I are practically the same person.
That's absurd, of course. But that's crazy to me, the driving from...
Yeah, think about driving to Guatemala.
I remember being in, when we were... I was in El Salvador.
In the 70s.
Yes, I was in El Salvador in 2020 when the pandemic broke out. And so there was discussions people were having because our flight was getting canceled and stuff like that. I was like, can we just drive home? Like, we ain't driving home from El Salvador. And then we eventually got a flight. We couldn't get flown back into America. So we got a flight back to Mexico City. And then we thought we had one out through there. And I get to Mexico City. I call Gail and I'm like, hey, we made it to Mexico City. And he goes, hey, just then worst case scenario, you guys can drive home from there. Like, I'm not driving from Mexico City. I'm sorry. I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to. And so that in and of itself is a brave.
It is amazing that he drove down there and he did it in part so he could take supplies down and take some of his stuff. But one of the, offshoot of that piece that I like about his story is so he would work on the Bronco while he was down there because obviously there's no mechanics in Guatemala. So anytime it broke down, which apparently happened a number of times, he would have to fix it. And being a farm kid, he could, but it would make him really cranky. And so like you read a shepherd who did not run and they talk a little bit about how he had a temper problem. Again, bringing that humanness to him that, this isn't some guy that's just cheery, sweet all the time. He had a temper. And one of the things that would cause his temper to flare was when his car wasn't working and he had to go and work on the engine. So much so that his secretary said, we would refer to those as the bear, as in the animal, the bear days. And so they would warn one another, the bear is out. So if you saw Father Stanley going to work on his Bronco, just it would go through the bear is out. Don't ask hard questions. Don't get in his way. Just kind of let this settle a little bit. But again, how real that is. And, you know, sometimes in the evening, I'm like, oh, I lost my temper with this. I'm such a terrible priest and that. But that's part of being human. And that's part of I am weak. I do have faults. And so did he. But that didn't keep him from becoming this just, again, wonderful shepherd and saint and loving priest. And so, again, that realness really is important and why I have such a strong affection for him.
So you're going to drive the Bronco to Guatemala?
I wouldn't say no if the bishop offered me that opportunity.
No. What are we talking about here?
Well, we are sending guys to Guatemala again this summer. So Bishop Kemi, if you're listening and you would like me to take the Bronco down to Guatemala, just give me a month and I'll do it.
Give me a month.
I'm sure... Don't people like they ride their bike across Kansas to raise awareness? I could drive my Bronco to Guatemala to raise awareness for the cause of Stanley Rother's sanctification. I really think that's a smart thing to do. I'm sure Father Ben Green would help me navigate. Be on board with that.
For the canonization, both Father Rother and Father Capon.
Dual canonization.
And you eventually, after your eventual demise on this terrible idea of a trip in this nice car. What are we talking about here?
Does it count as martyrdom if I run out of gas in El Salvador?
You're not going to make it. You're just going to be like on the side of the road in a country you don't know anything about and just end up dying there like Jack Carrot. Well, who that guy was that died in the bus?
Oh, yeah.
You're going to get lost in southern Mexico for sure.
And I do not have the mechanical skills that Father Stanley Rother does. All right. Probably best I don't drive to Guatemala this summer. I was going to, but now you've ruined my plan. Well, I think we'll have to leave it there for today. But if you want to learn more about Father Stanley Rother, Blessed Stanley Rother, I would highly encourage you to pick up the book, The Shepherd Who Didn't Run. It's wonderfully inspiring. If you find yourself in the Oklahoma City area in the near future, swing by their shrine. Or even if you're in Okarchee, Oklahoma, it's a beautiful little church. Highly recommend stopping and seeing some of those sites. Thanks for listening to About 4 O'Clock. If you have questions you'd like us to address, you can email us at wichitavocations@gmail.com. You can also visit us at our website, about4.org. The final word today goes to Father Drew.
We've been talking about Blessed Stanley Rother, a martyr in Central America. One of my great heroes is St. Oscar Romero, who was a martyr in El Salvador. And today is the feast day of Blessed Miguel Pro, another one of those saints who spilled blood in Central America for the Catholic Church. And so simply, Blessed Miguel Pro, in his last moments in front of a firing squad, cries out his last words, Viva Cristo Rey. Long live Christ the King.
See you next week. Thank you.